Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, filling in today for Diane while she's away on vacation. Ted Bundy, Charles Manson, Jeffrey Dahmer. These names conjure up the very essence of evil. Their crimes all appear on the highest levels of a new scale of evil developed by Dr. Michael Stone. The psychiatrist presents what he calls the gradations of evil scale in a new book. It's called The Anatomy of Evil, and Dr. Stone joins me in the studio this morning. Welcome. Thanks for being with us. You can join us as well. 1-800-433-8850 is our number. drshow@wamu.org is our email, or you can find us on Facebook, send us a tweet. And I should mention that Dr. Stone is also a professor of clinical psychiatry at the Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons. He's written a number of books, and also familiar to some of you, I'm sure, from the show he hosted on the Discovery Channel called Most Evil. I'm going to ask you a pretty simple question. Why would anybody spend their lives dealing with evil? What drew you to it?
Well, I started out as a psychoanalyst. Then I got interested in personality disorders because the people that were my main teachers and mentors were interested in borderline personality. And then as I got to be an expert in personality disorders, I would be asked occasionally to serve as expert witness in various cases, including a murder case some 22 years ago where a man had killed his pregnant wife and two children. And the question was, the author who wrote him up pictured him as being narcissistic and antisocial, and the man, although he was already in prison, objected to those terms as if that was a defamation of his nice character. And I was called in on the author's side, and of course I felt that he was narcissistic and antisocial and even worse. But that got me started in being interested in this whole extremes of personality. And I wanted to show the jury where this case fit in the grand scheme of violent crimes, especially murder. And so I began to develop the scale.
But this is pretty creepy. Can you sleep at night?
I've had a few bad dreams from interviewing some of these characters, but mostly I do sleep, yes.
What's the worst dream you've had?
Oh, I had, after interviewing Tommy Lynn Sells in death row in Texas, my first experience interviewing somebody in death row where you have 3 inches of glass between you and the prisoner, and you communicate by telephones on either side of the glass. And he had slit the throats of several dozens of women, many adolescents, and so on. And I thought, when I was about to go up and, you know, you don't shake hands, but meet him, I'd feel like killing him myself. So my first words were, I said, "Well, Tommy, I guess I got these 3 inches of glass between you and me, so I don't kill you and you don't kill me." And he said, "You got that right." But the thing was, unlike the other people I interviewed, he was very honest, and he talked about how he was filled with this anger at mankind, having been so mistreated when he was young. And now, when he would see the blood, the tissue separate and the blood come out, he said, "I would get me an adrenaline rush, and my anger would go away for 2 weeks, and then I'd have to do it again, but then that would fix my anger." Well, I had a dream that night, a nightmare, really, where I'm in a receiving line about to shake hands with a great man, except it's Hitler. And I'm like 10th in line, and I'm thinking, I have to shake hands with him. He's won an election, and I'm supposed to shake hands with
him. No 3 inches of glass between you.
No. And I thought, but I feel like killing him. But would that be murder? So I go off to the side where Dr. Kernberg, who was one of the men that I've worked with for many years, he's a very extremely well-known personality disorder expert, and he'd come from Vienna, et cetera. So I go over to Otto and I say, "Otto, you know, I'm supposed to shake hands with Hitler, but I feel like killing him. If I were to kill him, would that be murder?" And he said, "Well, in the case of Hitler, it would be all right."
Well, it's the whole question of evil is one, of course, that resonates through our culture. But people have different definitions of evil. You've defined it in a certain way.
Yes.
Give us your definition.
I use the popular way that people say the word under very special circumstances. And it's not just ordinary people, not just you and me, but judges, prosecutors. The defense doesn't use it very often. journalists and people who write true crime books and so on. They use it when there's often a violent crime that's particularly horrifying, nauseating, makes you wince, gives you an expression on your face that is really an emotion. So evil, to me, corresponds to an emotion that people register when they hear about one of these stories, such as John Evander Kui in Florida raping that 6-year-old girl and then burying her alive. And there are many other examples, some that are difficult to talk about on radio, that get that response. And people will then mouth the word evil. My God, that's evil.
So really, you are saying the public decides. This is not some separate moral standard of tablets
right.
on the wall.
That's not tablets. It's not, nothing to do with theological arguments about if God is good, how can he allow evil? Nothing like that. Because everybody uses the word and in a rather narrowly defined way, as I've just described.
You're almost describing like that famous definition of pornography. People know it when they see it. And
yes.
And that people have this visceral reaction to certain crimes and reach for this word to describe it.
Yes, I was just reading in my old book before coming on the show, the prosecutor who prosecuted Jessica Schwartz down in Florida after she killed but tortured this 10-year-old stepson. She'd done horrible things, including making him scrub the kitchen. And if he didn't do a perfect job, she would catch a roach and make him eat the roach. Okay? And many other things of that sort. So the prosecutor, he said, I don't know how to define evil, but I know it when I see it.
And that's what
and
we
she
see.
Was the embodiment of
but,
that.
But you also make the point that your definition of evil applies to humans and that it really cannot apply to animals for interesting reasons.
Yes, because I think we alone understand death and understand suffering, what we can subject another person to. And when a cat catches a mouse, it's having its supper. When a lion leaps on a gazelle, it's having its supper. It's not doing it with malice of forethought. It's not trying to subject a poor creature to suffering. And probably doesn't know about death in the way we know. Mm-hmm. So for me, evil, therefore, is a uniquely human phenomenon.
And also, more than 90% of the examples you use in your book are men.
Yes.
Talk about the implication of that figure.
Well, look, I like to think about life in the African savannah, not that I was there 50,000 years ago, but it seems to me our origins are in small tribes where there was a perimeter to be guarded, and then there was inner circle, where I suppose the fire was going to cook the food, that the men might be lucky enough to catch an animal to roast and so on, and the women took care of the children. So the men are wired, by nature to guard the perimeter, they're stronger, they weigh 1 1/3 times more than women, and they are the ones that fight the battles, etc. So we're more wired to be aggressive and less super friendly and affiliative the way women are wired, because they take care of babies that speak no language and are at the mercy of their mothers. So there is that difference in the psychology of the sexes that I think that accounts for the 5-to-1 or even 8-to-1 ratio of murderers, psychopaths to male psychopaths to female psychopaths, or male murderers to female murderers.
One of the other interesting definitions in your book, Dr. Stone, is that you kind of exclude mass murderers. I mean, you mentioned Hitler, but Hitler's not, you really make a distinction between war and peace,
yes.
between the psychology of the mob or gangs,
yes.
As opposed to, you're really talking about individuals here in this
right.
book.
Right. In the book, as I try to emphasize, I hope accurately enough so that people catch it, is it's about peacetime. When you get into wartime gangs, intergroup strife, then you're dealing with a different psychology because many people who can be pretty normal, productive citizens under ordinary circumstances can be yanked into a position of doing mm-hmm. some pretty atrocious stuff in wartime. So for me, that's like another, that's the next book. When you think about Bin Laden, we consider him evil, and I think, as I may have mentioned even in the book, if the Lord can hand us a piece of paper saying, well, I've reviewed the whole situation, and I think on balance, I have to say he was the evil one, and the Americans sitting in the World Trade Center Tower were not. But obviously, he and his henchmen and many people in that, part of the world felt that we were the great Satan, and these people in working in their offices at Cantor Fitzgerald and whatnot were evil soldiers of capitalism. We, of course, feel that they're evil people. And so there's subjectivity when you get into wartime situations. Mm-hmm. Now, really, history...
And you also have, as you point out, the psychology of the mob. You have the ideology, which came up, of course, in a lot of war crimes trials. So yes. What is the responsibility of the individual? Yeah. Was I just following orders?
Right.
In doing this, describe, before we take a break, this is a 22-point scale that you have.
Yes.
Tell our listeners what the range of it.
Well, I don't think there's in nature exactly 22 gradations of it. It was something that unfolded as I began to read more and more of these true crime books and get to know some of these prisoners. So I wanted to anchor it to a place where there wasn't evil. So I put number one as justified homicide, self-protective homicide. And then the least evil, I put jealousy murders that so many of us can understand. Husband comes home, sees the wife in bed with somebody, and he kills either the wife or the guy, or the woman kills the man who's cheated, like Gene Harris with the Scarsdale diet doctor. That's very understandable, although still wrong. And that was my least evil point. And at the other end, torture, prolonged torture.
Dr. Charles Stone, his book, Michael Stone, I'm very sorry. Michael Stone, his book is The Anatomy of Evil. We're going to be back with your calls and your comments in just a minute, so stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. My guest this hour, Dr. Michael Stone. His new book is The Anatomy of Evil. Dr. Stone has also been the host of a TV show on Discovery Channel, Most Evil, and leading expert on this whole question. And we were just discussing before the break, Dr. Stone, this 22-point scale going from sort of justifiable jealousy to... at the top of the scale, prolonged torture and before murder. And so on this, but even in these 22 gradations, are there traits, character traits, impulses that recur, that seem to define the people most prone to these kinds of acts?
Yes. For instance, the people... in the lower numbers, like up to, say, 9 or sometimes 10, are people that don't have the characteristics of the psychopath. The psychopath is the person, from a personality standpoint, that has the superficial charm and glibness of speech, the grandiosity, the manipulativeness and conning, and most particularly callousness, lack of compassion, and absence of remorse, and refusal to take responsibility for his actions. They also, many of them, the full-blown psychopaths, have behavioral stuff. They're impulsive. They do many kinds of crimes. But you also have, among more educated people, a kind of a white-collar psychopath that doesn't have so many of the behavioral things, or either that or their old man was able to get them off from petty crimes when they were kids, and they don't have an arrest record. But they have those personality traits. So the people in the higher numbers are the psychopaths. The lower down, you have these impulsive people, the ones that...
What defines a psychopath?
Those traits that I just mentioned. And in addition, some behavioral traits, parasitic, living off, sponging off others, impulsive lifestyle. And many of them also commit, they're like career criminals who commit many different kinds of crimes. So they'll do vandalism and driving while intoxicated and theft and robbery and escape. And they have a whole menu, which would be quite distinguishing. If you have five or six or seven different kinds of arrests, almost surely you're dealing with a psychopath. So, but the key qualities are the callousness, which allows a person to do unspeakable things to another human being as though he were whittling wood with no feeling.
And you also talk about the traits of narcissism and aggression that run through a lot of these case studies you've read.
Of course, in psychopathy, you could see as the far end of narcissism. Narcissism, egocentricity, self-centeredness. But when it gets into ruthlessness and lack of empathy and then has these other traits added, then it's shaded into psychopathy. So, yes, narcissistic. Almost all the people that I talk about are narcissistic because they care more about themselves than they do about you, or they wouldn't do the things that they did.
And what about this? I'm sure you get this question all the time, but are some people born evil? Is there a bad seed? I can't go to a movies without seeing a preview of a movie of some 8-year-old with red eyes, you know, that is, this person is evil. But what's your, as a doctor, what's your best assessment here?
I think I always have the picture when I'm asked that question of seeing, 100 babies in an obstetrical unit of some hospital in the obstetric. And you can't point to any little baby and say, that one's going to be evil. No. But there is, but so bad seed does have meaning because there are rare individuals who have a genetic predisposition to low compassion. They're born with something, some parts of the brain that are not operating at full tilt that impair their ability to feel sorry for the kid that's crying or whatever, to have compassion. And then if some other things go wrong later in life, then they may interact with that already not very good tendency to predispose them to do some horrific acts, which we then gasp at and say, wow, that's evil.
And you point out that there are cases of some of these studies, that you've read hundreds of them, where at least in some cases, this propensity to evil shows up very young. You can
see it in
children.
Oh, yes, indeed. The man that I found the most chilling, the one I think I had a little nightmare after interviewing him, was the cannibal in Montana, the one that died last year. he came from a family where he was not abused, he was not humiliated, he was not beaten, et cetera, et cetera. So, and his mom was very protective of him. But when he was about 7 or 8, he tried to kill a little girl. Then as he got into adolescence, he tried to waylay a couple of kids coming out of a movie with the object of kidnapping and sodomizing them and killing them. One of them managed to play dead and sneaked away. And he then told the police, and he was put then for 13 years in the same forensic unit that the Boston Strangler was in. And then his mother persuaded two psychiatrists to say he was okay now when he was in his early 30s, and the judge released him. He had never gone to any of the treatment. He just waved aside any efforts to be treated. And a few weeks after he was released, he tried to hurt another kid. The mother pleaded with the mother of the little boy that he tried to hurt, saying, please don't press charges. I will promise you my boy will move in with his brother, my son, in Montana, and he'll never come back to Massachusetts. In Montana, he did the same trick, dressing up as a policeman with a false badge, waylaid a 10-year-old coming out of school, immobilized him with a stun gun, dragged him to his apartment, sodomized him, killed him, and ate him. And what he didn't eat, he gave to the neighbors as though it were deer meat. Now, this is a fair, and then to see the wincing in your expression is exactly the facial expression that would have led you to say, wow, that's evil. That's the emotion.
Know that one when you see it. But in addition to heredity, And you've touched on this, but talk about it a little more. In your examination of these case studies, what are some of the other dimensions, the causations? You've talked about, say, childhood abuse as certainly one. And I know you also talk about mental illness, brain injuries. Yeah. Give us a sense of, you know, what recurs in these case studies.
Well, of course, the serial killers, the ones who do serial sexual homicide, which is what the public usually is thinking about when they hear or use the word serial killer, most of them, not all, but most of them have been abused or neglected outrageously in their early years. Of course, the most interesting ones to me are the ones that haven't been, because then I'm looking for birth, you know, like the mother had some problem during pregnancy or there was a hereditary factor. But the majority of them, nevertheless, have been abused or neglected during childhood. Some of them, a good many of them actually, have also suffered head injuries, very severe ones where they're unconscious during childhood, like Arthur Shawcross, who fell on his head 6 times and was unconscious, and apparently injuring key areas in the frontal lobe that mediate compassion the response, proper response to a crying child, etc. So if those areas are damaged, that's another factor that can predispose, you know, to committing terrible crimes.
And you also point, at least in some cases, to the impact of culture and violent cultures. Talk about that.
Well, there are cultures that are more celebrating of violence, more apt to endorse violent solutions, you know, to dealing with problems than others. To tell you the truth, I think there's a bit of that in our own country. I'm thinking back in Billy the Kid days. When I was growing up, I went to cowboy movies. Now, if you go to a movie or look in the airport books, you know, on your way to a trip, you see serial killer books and you see serial killer movies. So America has always had a kind of a love affair, in a way, you know, with violence. There are more violent cultures than ours, mind you, but we do have that tendency more than in some other countries, like when I was lecturing in Italy a couple of weeks ago, and they have hardly any serial killers, you know. So there is something different about certain
and
cultures.
Murder rates are very different.
Yes.
Often the point is made that British policemen don't wear guns. I mean, there are a lot of differences. We have some emails that I want to read you, and one of them gets to a point about the inspiration for your scale and the relationship to Dante and his work. And Jerome writes, "Hi, Dr. Stone. Ray, Dante's Contra Passos, poetic justice, the sentence fits the crime, or what goes around comes around. Is gluttony evil? Does one really deserve to live forever under a constant rain of urine and feces and adultery? Do Paolo and Francesca deserve what Dante gives them? And is murder in revenge for the death of a loved one evil?"
Well, there you have to go back to the origins of the words. And Italian, 14th century Italian included, the word malum meant bad, but it was also used for evil. If you read the speech to the Galatians by St. Paul, he enumerates a whole lot of evil things, but they're just bad things. Some of them are things we would call evil, like murder and torture or whatever, but most of them drunkenness, adultery, so that the word evil in some languages covers a much wider territory of disagreeable things that fall very far short of our word evil, which we reserve for the horrific.
And here's Kathleen writing to us from Athens, Ohio. "Jeffrey Dahmer and the other psychopathic killers mentioned are clear examples of evil actions. How would you describe those who use powerful positions to promote unnecessary wars based on lies that have resulted in massive amounts of people being killed, injured, and evil? Are these forms of evil in your book?"
They're forms of evil, but they're in my next book. and incidentally, Dahmer, I was on a show. There was a show devoted to Jeffrey Dahmer in New York City a couple of months ago, and they had myself and Catherine Ramsland, who was a very fine forensic psychologist, talk afterwards to the audience. And so I studied Dahmer a little more than usual. And actually, Dahmer is unusual because you mentioned about mental illness. Mm. He had Asperger's syndrome, which is a kind of a high-level autism in a way, where the person becomes preoccupied with one thing in life and just devotes his energies to that and is unable to make friends, unable to make eye contact, and so on. Dahmer was preoccupied as a kid with the insides of animals. He would look at roadkill, and he'd like to look at all the pretty colors of the different organs, which, of course, he then carried forward into his murders, where he would ultimately dismember his victims and look at the pretty colors of the organs. So, but he wasn't flat-out schizophrenic, but he was a very odd loner with this Asperger syndrome that was predisposing him to do these terrible things. He's different from a flat-out psychopath like Ted Bundy, who was very charming, would get on the suicide...
Or Charles Manson being...
Charles Manson, absolutely. So those are the more... if you want to know, without going through a whole list of traits, what is the psychopath, just talk about, as you say, Manson and Bundy.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Final question. We'll get to our callers. As it comes up with all issues involving genetics and heredity... talk about both the positives and the potential negatives of trying to isolate genetic tendencies in people who might be prone to evil or violence. And what's your feeling about the utility of trying to do that?
Well, I think there is some utility. For instance, people who study violence now are more aware of what they call callous, unemotional youths. Boys, usually, more often than girls, who have this compassionless personality, unemotional, nothing seems to, you know, stir them one way or the other. And the question is, can something be done with them? Now, there's another group of what's called adolescent onset, antisocial kids, who are not particularly callous, unemotional like this other group. That other group is more like they're born with that. The ones who are adolescent onset often have certain peculiarities in their brain chemistry, etc., and they can be worked with. And if you catch them early, after they've done a few bad things, they can often be worked with in such a way that they spin out of it as they get into their 20s and 30s, and so they can live productive lives. The callous, unemotional ones usually mature into your standard psychopaths, and they're a pretty untreatable group. But at least the fact that there's within the total package of kids who do wrong things, a group of probably a larger group of salvageable ones is worth paying attention to.
That's a totally understandable idea, but is there also a risk that if someone is branded because they carry a genetic marker of some sort, and yet they haven't acted on it or haven't acted it out? I mean, there is a line there of ethical concern, isn't there, for a doctor?
There is, but I think we know a lot more now that if you have certain genes, that it doesn't doom you to a particular behavior because the genes and the environment interact in very complicated ways. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about nature versus nurture these days. We talk about nature and nurture interacting. And so that many things which may relate to genetic predisposition can nevertheless be altered under certain circumstances in a favorable way.
And an unfavorable way, both.
And in an unfavorable way. But we, of course,
doctor. What you say, as a doctor, you can, but that principle holds on both ways. You've studied cases where people might have a predisposition which they don't act on, but others, when on top of a heredity, whether it's an uncaring parent or a brain injury, that can trigger a spiral into violence.
We know, for example, that there are kids who have a shorter version of a particular gene that's studied by Avshalom Kaspi and his wife, Terry Moffitt. If those kids are raised by compassionate parents, nothing happens. Hmm. If they're raised by parents that are a bit brutal, they go on to antisocial acts. So that there's a situation we can tell if we studied their, took blood and studied their genome, we could say, well, these kids are at risk. But this particular kid is less at risk because his folks are real nice. And this other kid we're worried about because he comes from a family that's very punitive, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And there might be some way of either trying to educate the parents and invite them into some form of family therapeutic situation, or in extreme cases, to get that kid out of a destructive environment into a better environment so that he doesn't have to pay the price of his genetic tendency.
Be more specific about what the qualities are in a parent that can both either aggravate these tendencies or alleviate them.
Well, certainly parents that are extremely humiliating verbally, that's one bad thing. If they punish the kid drastically for a very petty offense, that's another thing. If they are outrageously neglectful or disappear, et cetera, so these are all risk factors. Mm-hmm. This fellow I mentioned whose mom, well, his stepmother, made him eat a roach. She also shamed him in ways that I can hardly talk about on the radio.
Okay, Michael Stone, his book, The Anatomy of Evil. We're going to get to your calls when I come back with Dr. Stone, so you stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Judd Apatow, the director of the comedies Knocked Up and 40-Year-Old Virgin, has written and directed the new film comedy Funny People. It stars Apatow's former roommate, Adam Sandler, as a comedy star diagnosed with an incurable blood disorder. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. My guest this hour is Dr. Michael Stone. His book is The Anatomy of Evil. And Dr. Stone, I have several more emailers who want to join this conversation. This is from a Dr. King, who writes to us, "As a cultural anthropologist interested in the ways that different societies construct and live out the notion of self and other, I could not help noticing that your description of the people who fall into the middle range, that is, narcissistic and ruthless, but not yet psychopathological, could fit the people considered to be successful in the U.S., corporate execs, Wall Street movers and shakers. The U.S. public fascination with mafia programs, The Sopranos, etc., also evidences an admiration of predators and con artists. How can we deal with this in the U.S.?
That's a big question. It's true that many of those people have narcissistic qualities and some psychopathic traits, the so-called white-collar psychopath who can con and manipulate. But again, we try to deal with it by law, but sometimes they're cleverer or have more power than we, like Carlos Marcello and Sandro Strappicante and Gianni Rosselli during the time of the Kennedy assassinations, for which they seem to be largely responsible. Those were very powerful guys. Of course, again, that's group stuff. That's, you know, one group pitted against another. My book was focusing on individuals. But another thing about the narcissists who don't go on to serial killing and torture, there was the middle group in my scale. Many of them are spouses, again, more husbands than wives, who scheme and plot to get rid of their spouse, but in very clever ways, or sometimes scheme and plot, as in the case of Steve Benson, to put a bomb in his mom's car in order to accelerate his inheritance. So they're psychopathic schemers. They kill quick, and they don't torture, but they are sure a long ways from just the impulsive, you know, barroom brawlers.
Well, what we're seeing in these emails is a lot of people sort of wrestling with the definition of evil, which you've tried to define. But here's another example. Mark from Salt Lake City writes, Bernie Madoff callously impacted the lives of far more people than any mass murderer for far longer. He wasn't violent in the traditional sense, though. Where do you place a guy like that on your scale?
Well, he wouldn't fit on the scale, which is really primarily having to do with murder. If I had to, I might put him on 16, which is multiple vicious acts of defrauding others. But I'm interested in the observation. The only person who was called evil, who didn't do a violent crime, in my reading, and my reading is extensive on these kind of things, in recent years is about Bernie Madoff, because the judge who sentenced him said, you are an extraordinarily evil man. I use the word evil. And I plot all these things. So, and the evil there, one of the things, he's indirectly responsible for the deaths of a certain number of people who committed suicide, honorable people who were bankers, who were fooled into investing with him, and then who felt terribly responsible for the people who put their money with them. Whereas Bernie has a big smile on his face, he could care less.
And finally, an email from Cape May, New Jersey. Many people who are evil are actually mentally ill. They can be born with brain infections. We see people who have neurological Lyme disease and their behavior is evil. When, quote, cured, their behavior becomes normal. Please talk about infections. I saw this often in my psychological practice. Many were not abused. There is a book for doctors called Neuropsychiatric Disorders and Infections.
Well, the limited experience I have with Lyme disease, I remember being an expert witness in a Lyme disease case of a woman that tried to kill somebody. She blamed it on the Lyme disease. I'm a little unconvinced, quite frankly. I looked at the whole Lyme disease literature at the time, which was about 2-3 years ago, and could only come up with a dozen or so cases around the world of people that appeared to have abnormal responses of a violent nature. You know, and sometimes it was very hard to really attribute it in a scientifically mm-hmm. compelling way to the Lyme disease. But as for meningitis, which is there are several of the serial killers, including Tommy Lynn Sells, the one I interviewed between the 3 inches of glass, who had meningitis when he was 2. His twin sister died, and he blamed his mom, for the shabby care that they got, etc. And of course, I work in a forensic hospital where there are schizophrenic people and people who abuse marijuana heavily when they're adolescents and become schizophrenic-like, and who do extraordinarily violent crimes that you no question the public would react to with evil, such as lopping off a father's head and throwing it out the window so that because of the fear that it might become reattached to the dad and dad would be mean to him all over again, stuff like that. But these people are often more salvageable because when you give them proper treatment, for their mental illness, they can lead lives that are okay. Some of them, of course, you worry, well, are they really going to take the medication that you prescribe? So that it becomes a question of how good they are about following the recommendations. But yes, mentally ill people are about 5 times more likely to commit a violent crime than normal people, but that's 5% rather than 1%, so 95% of mentally ill people don't. But when they do, it's so spectacular that the public gets very worried and frightened.
And then you get to the stigma problem of standing for everyone.
That's right.
Let's talk to Keith in Rochester, New York. Keith, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Yes, Dr. Stone, some of the definitions of a psychopath that you are subscribing to that category should more easily be given over to the lower echelon sociopaths. At least 5% of the general population is sociopathic, and I'm concerned that you're really confusing the definitions of what is truly evil. Let me give you a blatant example. Nazi medical staff went out of their way to find true sociopaths to fill the ranks of Waffen-SS. Even in the early years, the Nazi leadership knew that true killers would be needed to do despicable acts that mere hedonistic sociopaths, as you were describing, could never be counted to do, to follow through on. On this day, this very day in history, in 1934, John Dillinger was shot dead. He most certainly was more of a sociopath than a true psychopath. And when confronted with true evil, and this is what is really missing in the general population, I'm very concerned that you, as a true professional, are just overusing that term psychopath. It's like people riding in an airplane. As long as they get there safely, they don't care how the pilot is driving. It's the same way with evil. When you come upon a psychopath, you already know, as I do, there's no saving that psychopath. The only thing for him is capital punishment, and I just think you're reinforcing too much to the general audience that psychopaths are much more common when you should be using that S word, sociopath.
Thank you very much, Keith. Dr. Stone.
And there's some definitional matters here. Sociopath is not an accepted term in the standard diagnosis any more than a psychopath. Psychopath is more used in legal circles because it is accepted in by people like in the forensic community, for example. The word sociopath tends to be used by people who are a little bit reluctant to use the word psychopath, so that it's like psychopathy light. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, not every psychopath does things which are rise to the level of evil. And I would dispute very much your comment about the Nazi times. There are indeed some of the people who were chosen to be, you know, participants in those camps who were picked because of their thug-like tendencies. That's absolutely true. You're right there. But there were also, especially during the Einsatzgruppen, people who, you know, shot tons of Jews in the towns of Poland, you know, during the later times and when the war was already on, who were ordinary enlisted men who could be pressed into service to do that. And if they didn't want to, they could be excused without being, you know, shot by their officers, etc. So that there were many who were neither psychopathic nor sociopathic, just ordinary soldiers who would participate in, you know, mass shootings of people who were lined up in front of mass graves. So it's a much more complicated picture.
Let's turn to Mark in Aurora, Illinois. Mark, you're on the Diane Dream Show. Welcome. Mark? No? Okay, let's turn to Roger in Cincinnati, Ohio. Welcome, you're on the Diane Dream Show.
Hi, Dr. Stone. I'd like to bring up the point that I think that the word evil itself is maybe should be retired because it has almost a supernatural element to it. There are many other terms that we can use to describe these people. I even had a devout Christian friend of mine tell me one time that there has to be a God because how else can you explain evil in the world? And I just couldn't buy that. And another thing I'd like to say is I think it's a myth that there are no other examples in the animal kingdom of malicious killings, because I've seen on the animal planet where they were rhinoceroses were coming up dead, and they didn't know why, and they found out that they were young buck elephants that were picking fights with rhinoceroses just so they could kill them. So there are some examples in the animal kingdom of malicious murder, you know, just for people, just killing for fun, in other words, you know.
Okay, Roger, thank you so much for your time. Thank you. What's your response to Roger?
I tried to make very plain in my book and all the way through it that evil is a term used by many, 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 many people all around the world to refer to horrific acts of violence. If you only are willing, you know, to think of it in theological terms, I feel that you're absolutely lost, because then you're out of touch with the way ordinary folk use the word. That's a whole other subject. And indeed, I've worked on a book. I have already chapters written about what theologians and philosophers have said about evil going back 3,000 years. That's a different subject. You don't have to believe or not believe about, you know, God is good, he couldn't, therefore he couldn't make evil, or maybe he could under certain circumstances. That is all the way to the side of the point that in everyday speech, we use the word all the time for the very kinds of crimes that I was talking about.
But it is the callers do reflect the fact that many people define evil in very different ways, and it grows out of their own religious beliefs, their own cultural beliefs, their own instincts, so that, and our callers have shown that.
Yes.
Let's turn to Earl in Hollywood, Florida.
Welcome. Hello, good day.
You're on the Diane Rehm Show. Welcome.
Hello, good day. If you say that evil is a subjective call, human judgment, then there is no ultimate evil. And that would remove the concept that there is a devil, which is opposition to God. The devil in opposition with is only a concept of mankind, which religions are as well. They view nothing to do with, per se, God, nor does the devil.
Thank you very much, Earl.
Well, the fact that evil is a subjective call has more weight than you may want to credit it, because if 99.5% of the people, let's say, call a particular act, you know, such as a horrific murder, evil, then that's it becomes at that point a shared use of the term, and it becomes objective by that point, even though for each individual it's his own emotional reaction.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Time for one or two more, and let's go to Scott in Annapolis, Maryland. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Scott.
Hi. Thanks for having me. So I just wanted to tell Dr. Stone, thank you for all your work. The Most Evil Show is just it's a great documentary. We just enjoy that. I did have a question with regards to spree killers. I had noticed earlier this year in April that we had basically about 7 consecutive days of spree killers in the United States. Now, knowing that we've had Charles Whitman's and Starkweather's, and that this is not a new trend, with the Virginia Tech shooting and these other occurrences, do you think that this is a trend that is going to continue, get worse, or is it primarily just isolated in our culture?
I think it's hard to say. My own reaction was, and I don't know if I'm right, was that as the recession deepened, and it got very deep, as you know, in March was, I think, when the Dow Jones was down to 6,500, there were a lot of what I call familicides. In other words, where there would be somebody killing his whole family and maybe a few other people, another couple of neighbors or whatever else. They seemed to be related to somebody who became profoundly demoralized by losing his job, no longer able to, you know, support his family, etc. Those seemed to be the ones who cropped up, and I was wondering whether that was a trend and a trend that would continue as long as the recession was, you know, very bad and many people lost their jobs, and would lighten as things got better. But, you know, in order to know that, you have to keep track of scientifically of all the incidents of spree murder and familicides over a long period of time, and see whether it goes up during such a time as ours now, and whether it goes back down again as when, thank heaven, the economy improves.
But that's another example of what we were saying earlier about how all your research says that this is a combination of nature and nurture, a combination of predisposition and cultural and individual factors that can trigger these kind of outbursts.
And because they're rare examples, it takes a long time before you know whether, like suicide, murder, and familicide and spree killing, they're kind of rare events, so that if it goes from 7 to 11, maybe that doesn't mean anything. If it goes from 7 to 30 in a brief period of time, that's more suggestive.
Well, the other controlled population that we've seen a real spike is in returning military from the war zones.
Yes.
And that must interest you as a case study of outside events triggering
some
of these impulses.
The murder rate in returning men from combat has gone up over after every war, but particularly wars that are unpopular like Vietnam and this thing in Iraq. I don't know whether there was an increase in murder after World War II. I'm sure if I delved into it, I could find out. But there certainly was a lot of men who came back hardened by what they saw. Their personalities were very upset and damaged by seeing their buddies killed and things of that sort. And they also had these post-traumatic stress reactions where they would have hair trigger responses, and you know, something they saw that bothered them, they would fly into action. You know.
You've been listening to Dr. Michael Stone. His new book is The Anatomy of Evil. Dr. Stone, thanks so much for sharing an hour with us here on the Diane Rehm Show.
It's been my pleasure.
I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane while she's away on vacation. And thank you, our listeners, for sharing your morning with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org.